Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you so much for supporting our author events and also for supporting independent bookstores. We certainly appreciate that. It is always a pleasure for me to introduce Colorado's New York Times best-selling author, Margaret Cole. Her newest novel in the award-winning Wind River Mystery Series is The Spider's Web. It's the time of the annual Sundance on the Wind River Reservation, the ancient sacred ceremony that unites Arapahoes in prayer and peaceful renewal. Yet, when a blonde, beautiful outsider arrives on the res, murder, suspicion, and recrimination follow in her path. Soon, Arapaho attorney Vicki Holden and Father John O'Malley are involved and also are at odds. Margaret Cole has won many awards, and one of the most recent is the Frank Waters Award of 2010, given to her by the Friends of the Pikes Peak Library District, and it stands for Exemplary Literary Achievement, as well as a canon of writing that communicates a deep understanding and celebration and love of human nature and peoples of all races. Please welcome Margaret Cole.
Thank you, Lisa. And I want to thank the Tattered Cover, this wonderful independent bookstore here in Denver, for hosting me yet again. This is the 15th novel in my Wind River Mystery Series. Tattered Cover has had me here for every single novel. And before I started writing the novels, I was writing history books, and Tattered Cover had me here for those too. So what an incredible bookstore, and we're fortunate to have this wonderful place. In fact, I wonder sometimes what would Denver be like if we didn't have the Tattered Cover. It's hard to imagine. So thank you so much, and thank all of you for coming out tonight. As I said, this is the 15th novel, and I often have people come up to me and they'll say, you know, I've read all your novels, and I want to go into the mode of one of my characters, Father John O'Malley. I'm very tempted to go into that mode and say, oh, bless you, bless you, bless you, my child. I mean, that's a lot of novels. So I'm frequently asked, are you going to get tired of these characters, Father John and Vicki Holden, the Arapaho lawyer? And Father John is a Jesuit priest on the Wind River Reservation, and they work among the Arapahos who are on the reservation, along with the Shoshones. They're there too, but they're really associated with the Arapaho people. So I'm asked, why are you ever going to get tired of them? Well, I haven't so far, and we've come a long way, Father John and Vicki and I, and they're still surprising me. So I guess if the day comes when they stop surprising me, that'll be the day that I'll know the series is over. But so far, I never quite know what they're going to do, and I always think my challenge is to put some really tough obstacles in their path and really make things hard for them. In fact, my editor said to me one time, Margaret, he said, you seem like a pretty nice person, but you're so mean to Father John and Vicki. But I'm just making things tough for them because to me that's interesting. So I like to come up with some really hard things for them, and then I sit back and I think, okay, now what are you going to do now? Let's see how you're going to handle that one. And so far, they handle whatever I throw at them, and actually, as I say, they still surprise me. So where did they come from? People ask me that also. How did I get these ideas? And in fact, today I was being interviewed, and the interviewer asked, this is what she said. She said, Father John and Vicki seem so real. She said, I wonder if they're based on real people. And so I said, no, they're total fiction. And then I had this pang of, like I had said something really bad about my best friends because they seemed real to me, you know, and I don't want to hurt their feelings by telling them that they're actually, they're not real, they're fictional. But I know that on the reservation, one of the guessing games that's played is, who are they really? So everybody has a different idea of who Father John and Vicky might actually be. And interestingly enough, when the first novel came out, The Eagle Catcher, now it had come out, okay? I wasn't just writing it. It was published. And I was on the reservation, and there was this wonderful Jesuit priest there who was associated with the mission, the real mission that's there, which is St. Stephen's Mission. And I call it St. Francis Mission in my novels, but this man's name was also Father John. It wasn't Father John O'Malley. It was Father John. And I kept hearing about him. But every time that I went to the reservation, he wasn't around. He'd be off somewhere else or off working somewhere or on a sabbatical or whatever. So I never actually got to meet this man. But then The Eagle Catcher came out, and everybody was convinced this was Father John, based on the actual Father John. And I got to meet him finally. And in fact, my husband and I went out to dinner with him, this darling little cafe that's on the reservation. And what a terrific guy. I mean, just a wonderful person. I remember he had on a baseball cap with a ponytail hanging out of it, you know, one of those caps. And he rode around in an old pickup, and he had this dog that he took everywhere with him. So I could see why people thought, really, I probably had based my Father John on this Father John. But I had not. I had never even met the man. But I remember that we went to dinner this one evening, and he had to leave early because he was going to a baby shower. So the people loved him. They just loved him, and they made him one of their family. So my character was not based on him, but maybe I was channeling something. I don't know. But it was not based on him, and yet I think Father John is that kind of character. He hasn't been invited to a baby shower yet, but you never know. That could happen, and he would go, that's for sure. So where did they come from? I wanted to write about, when I was thinking about writing The Eagle Catcher, and I started thinking, well, who are these, who will my sleuths be, my main sleuths? The one thing I knew I wanted was an outsider, which is what I am. I'm an outsider to the Arapaho culture. Everyone asks me, as I go around the country, the first question out of their mouths is, are you Arapaho? And I always say no, of course, because I'm not. And then they argue with me. And they say, well, maybe you are. Maybe you don't know what you really are. And I say, no, I do, and I know I'm not Arapaho. And finally, I've learned to say, you know, the only people who never ask me if I'm Arapaho are the Arapahos. So I knew that I wanted a sleuth who was like me, an outsider to the reservation. I really thought that it would be a woman. I never thought I would be writing about a priest. So I started thinking, who would this sleuth be? Well, who are the outsiders on the reservation? Well, certainly an FBI agent. That would have been cool, I guess. There are all kinds of people. Medical people, doctors, nurses, librarians, teachers, all kinds of people. But and they're all wonderful professions. But I wasn't getting really, really excited about any of them. And then I dream a lot. When I'm thinking about characters and I'm thinking about plots and all, I really dream about them. And so this tall, good-looking, red-headed Irishman started walking around in my dreams. And then I found out he's a priest. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And then it all made sense. In my waking hours, in my rational mind, I thought, okay, this makes sense. Because there is a mission on the Wind River Reservation. It's run by the Jesuits up until just recently when they had to let it go, and it's been taken over by another group of priests. But it's a historic mission. After the Arapahos went to the reservation in 1878, just a few years after that, the leaders went to Omaha, I mean the tribal leaders went to Omaha and asked the Jesuits to come and educate their children because they knew their children were going to have to move into a different world and follow a different road, as they put it. So the Jesuits came. They gave them the land upon which to build the mission. They helped them build the mission. It's a beautiful mission. If you ever go up to the reservation, don't miss it. It's a beautiful mission with a wonderful church that it's a chapel, but it's beautiful. It has all stained glass windows, and they're all done in Arapaho symbols. So it's a very, very lovely place. But anyway, I thought, well, this would be perfect. I'm going to have this sleuth who's a Jesuit priest. I thought, oh, gosh, well, that's going to be interesting. And, in fact, sometimes I'm asked, you know, what's it like to write about another culture? And I always want to say, you mean the Jesuits? You know, so I thought, well, okay, I've got this priest. But he's part of something. He's an outsider. And then I decided he's really an outsider. I wanted him to be not only an outsider to the Arapaho people, but an outsider to the West. So he comes from Boston. He's an Easterner. And, you know, he has a lot to learn. He has had everything to learn. So, but he's connected to something that's been a part of the reservation from almost the beginning. Now, the thing is, when you have these amateur sleuths, why in heaven's name would they get involved in solving murders, which is what I'm committing here in these novels? In fact, one time I asked a friend of mine, a priest, and I said, what would you do if you found a body? He said, if I found a body? He said, I'd call the police. So why would they get involved? But the wonderful thing about both my sleuths, about Father John and about Vicky, who's an attorney, is that these are people that when people are in trouble, they're going to turn to people like that. They're going to go, you're going to go to your minister, to your rabbi, to your priest, whatever, at the hard times in your life. This is somebody that people are going to trust. And he's a white man. And so often when you get involved in crime, and then the Arapaho people are caught up in this huge white justice system, they need someone they can turn to who can interpret this system to them and help them through this. And Vicky the same way. Vicky is Arapaho, but she left the reservation, came to Denver to become educated, became a lawyer. Her whole goal in life is to protect the rights of her people. Always the law was always used against Native peoples. Her goal is to use the white man's law for Native peoples. So that's what she does. So they're both, in a way, they're both outsiders. Father John is, of course, because he's from Boston. Vicky is because once she left the reservation and went into the white world and became educated, and then she's gone back, she's a different person. And especially the grandmothers look a little askance at her. They say she's stepped out ahead of the men and made herself a chief. So it's difficult for her, and they've called her, they gave her a name, Hisei Sinihi, which means woman alone. I, incidentally, maintain I'm learning a few words of Arapaho. My Arapaho friends dispute this. A great Arapaho chief who was here on the plains when the Arapahos lived here on the plains of Colorado. His name was Left Hand. And my first book actually was a history of the Arapahos and a biography of this chief. And it's called, the book is called Chief Left Hand. But anyway, his Arapaho word is Niwot. And the town of Niwot is named for him. But it's not pronounced Niwot in Arapaho. It's pronounced, I say something like Niwatha. But I was talking to an Arapaho-speaking friend of mine not long ago, and we started talking about Chief Left Hand, so I called him by his Arapaho name. I called him Niwatha. And she got this startled look on her face, and then she burst into laughter, and she started laughing and laughing until tears were running down her cheeks. And then she said, well, I said to her, well, after she had composed herself, I said, what did I say? And she said, oh, you don't want to know what you said. So I still don't know what I said. Arapaho is a very, very beautiful language. I've heard it spoken many, many times. But as I say, you know, I don't speak it. So these are the two characters. This is where they came from. Why do I write about the Arapahoes? Because I'm a fourth-generation Coloradan. I grew up here with all the stories of the past, of our area. I grew up with a very strong sense of place. And I became very interested, I mean, early in my life, in the Native peoples who had lived here. And on the plains of Colorado were the Arapahoes and Cheyennes. In the mountains were the Utes. And I always read everything I could about those tribes. I wanted to know how they lived. I wanted to know where they lived. Where were their villages? Where were their battlegrounds? Where were their burial grounds? Where are the forts where they traded? Where were these things? I now know, because over the years I've gone to all these places, and for the Arapahoes at least. So that's what really started me on that journey. And as I say, what happened, I got very interested in Chief Left Hand, this particular leader in the mid-1800s, and ended up writing this book about him. At the time, I was writing magazine articles. And so I thought, gee, he sounds like an interesting character. I'm going to write a magazine article about this guy. And I started doing the research. And I researched and researched. It took me into the Arapaho world. I started going to the reservation. I got the chance to talk to and to interview some of the elders. And this was in the late 1970s. So the people I was talking to who were in their 90s, you can tell how far back they went. And if they didn't have their personal knowledge of having lived on the plains, as they say, having lived free on the plains, they had firsthand stories from their parents who had lived free on the plains and their grandparents. So I was very fortunate in that I got to meet and talk to a number of these people. So it was really that book that took me into the Arapaho world. And doing the research and all, I spent 5 years on that. It was a labor of love, not knowing if anyone would ever read it, not knowing certainly if anyone would ever publish it, but I was obsessed with it. I was going to write it no matter, and I did. But there was one point while I was doing all this research, and I've been after it for 5 years. And remember, I had started out to write a magazine article, and there was one point where I realized, you know, I have here a 350-page magazine article. So that turned into a book. Eventually, I went on. And I wrote 4 other nonfiction books. But eventually, I got around to finally doing what I'd always wanted to do, which was write novels. And I have always followed the advice that a writing teacher gave me many years ago, which was write what you love to read. So I love to read history. I wrote history. I love to read biographies. I wrote biographies. I love to read mysteries. So when I decided to write a mystery novel, I thought it's going to be, obviously, it's going to be a mystery. And why mysteries? I think there are, actually, there's a lot in common. History and mystery have a lot in common because there are a lot of mysteries in history. And I spent a lot of years researching and trying to find evidence to back up what might have happened in the past. And I think Father John and Vicki do that now in the novels. They're always looking for evidence to back up what might have happened. Because the Arapahoes were here on the Central Plains, they were connected with everything that happened out here in the West. I love the history of the West, and so I love to bring in the history in my different novels. So everything from, let's say, Wife of Moon, which dealt with the time that Edward S. Curtis, the great photographer who went around the West, or the American West, between 1900 and 1930, photographing the Indian tribes. He went to the reservation in about 1907. And, of course, he was involved in photographing the Arapahoes. So that gave me something to write about. That gave me a story. I got an idea of, well, what might have happened back then? And how would that translate into the present? If there was a crime that was committed then, how would that affect the present? And would it lead to another crime in the present? And, yes, indeed, it does in my book, Wife of Moon. The Girl with Braided Hair came out a few years ago, deals with AIM, the American Indian Movement. And I'd been really interested in that and had wanted to write about that for a while because, of course, the Arapahoes were involved with that, too. And that was the the Native American Civil Rights Movement. And it was like all of the civil rights movement in the 60s and the 70s here in this country. It was a two-edged sword. There were a lot of good things that came out of it, but it was also a violent and turbulent time. And that was certainly true in Indian country. So I'd wanted to write about that, and I decided that I would set my novel in 1973 on the Wind River Reservation. And while I was working on it, I went out to give a talk at a book club or something, and people always ask me, well, what are you working on now? And so I told them what I was working on. And about two or three days later, I got a phone call from a woman in Portland. And she said, I understand you're writing about AIM on the Wind River Reservation in the 1970s. I said, yes, I am. She said, well, I was there. And I was a member of AIM. And I said, wow, okay. So I went and got my tablet and my pen, and I'm all ready to interview her. And then she said, and I kept a journal. She said, would you like to read my journal? I said, yeah. Yes, please, I said. And so she copied her journal and sent it to me. Well, it was wonderful. It was filled with so many wonderful stories and with such a sense of the tension that was on the reservation at that time and the fear and the divisiveness. I mean, it was really, really incredible. So I called her and said, gee, this is wonderful. I'd like to work some of these things into my novel. Would that be all right with you? She said, oh, I'd love it. Oh, she said, I would love it. Please do. So I did. So I think it gave it so much more authentic. You don't usually get the chance when you're bringing some history into a novel. You don't really get the chance to get that close to the history. So that was wonderful. My novel, Killing Raven, dealt with casinos, and that's a part of their history. It's recent history. The effort of tribes all across the country to build casinos. There are something now like over 500 Indian casinos. So that's recent history, but it really is part of the history of the tribes and certainly of the Arapaho culture, where gambling and gaming has always been a part of their culture, very natural part of their culture. So I wanted to write about that. When I started doing the research and getting ready to write the book, the Arapahos did not have a casino, but they were trying to get one. And so under the Indian gaming law, if a state allows gambling for any reason whatsoever, and then the tribes within that state want to have a casino, then the state is supposed to make a compact with them so they can have their casino. Well, the state of Wyoming was not going to have a casino. That's the end of the story. However, Wyoming has always been sort of a wide open place when it comes to gambling. You know, there's slot machines at the Elks Hall, and there's always bingo, you know, going on different places. And when you're up there in visiting, which I'm there a lot, you'll see in the newspaper, you know, Saturday night, everybody come for fun night. You know, come to the local Grange or whatever, fun night. So there's always a lot of gaming that's always gone on and throughout Wyoming's history. So when the state said no to the tribe, actually, they fought a legal battle for 7 years. It went all the way through the federal courts, all the way, and then every time it would get, the tribe was always winning. They would always get, a decision in their favor, and then the state would come back with some other objection. So they would fight it over again. Well, finally, the lawyers who were working for the tribe hired an investigator to go out around the state and take photographs of all the different gaming that does go on in the state. And they got a wonderful picture of the governor shooting craps, which the federal judge loved. And I think the lawyers even loved it more. Well, they eventually got their casino. But I gave them a casino first, I have to tell you. I gave them the first casino on the Wind River Reservation, but they now have a really wonderful one. So, as I say, just about every book will deal with some part of history, some little piece of it that interests me. Last year, the book that came out is called The Silent Spirit. And that was another one that I'd wanted to write about for quite a while. And that dealt with the the time in the 1920s when the Arapahos and the Shoshones from the Wind River Reservation went to Hollywood to be in some of the early cowboy and Indian films, the old silent westerns. And they are very proud of this. They're very proud that their ancestors were in the movies. And they have this connection to Hollywood. And I knew this, and I'd read a lot about it, and I talked to people who would say, oh, yeah, my great-grandfather, my grandfather, he was in the movies. So I thought this would be fun to write about. And then I thought, but I do write murder mysteries, and I was trying to figure out, well, how am I going to get a mystery into this? And then I started doing research on Hollywood in the 1920s. Oh, my goodness. It was like a mystery novel waiting to be written. Hollywood was really a wild and crazy place back then. Everything went. Everybody was, they were drinking orange blossoms, which was vodka, gin, and orange juice. And they were all on cocaine. And they were, you know, everybody sleeping with everybody else. I mean, it was just, it was a wonderful place, I guess. But the studios tried to keep this hidden because they didn't think that the people out in Des Moines, you know, and places like that would approve because they weren't doing those things. I said this one time to a group of people and somebody said, oh, yeah, they were. So, but the studio heads didn't think they were. So they tried to keep all this undercover. And there are actually murders that were committed and that are cold cases still today. Because if they involved the film people, everybody knew you don't call the police. You call the studio who sends out the fixers who then clean everything up, you know, and make sure there's no evidence around to implicate anybody in the film industry. And then they call the police. But it didn't matter because the police and the DA were pretty much controlled by the studios anyway. So I had so much fun doing all this research and going to Hollywood and walking up and down Hollywood Boulevard and going to Grohmann's and Egypt and Grohmann's Chinese and Egyptian theaters and eating at Frank and Musso's, I think it is, restaurant, which still has Charlie Chaplin's booth. You know, it's just so much fun. And then to think that the Arapahos, after they were in the covered wagon, which was one of the first major Western epic. And actually, I got a copy of it, a DVD on the internet, and it's a darn good movie. And it's even more fun when you look at it and you see all the Indian people in it are from the reservation. So, but anyway, then some of them came to Hollywood after the movie was made and to promote the film, which was being shown every night at Grohmann's Egyptian Theater. And they would put on an Indian vaudeville show before the film. Well, while they were doing this, they were camped in their teepees on Quanga Pass, which is like a mile up out of Hollywood. And every day they would ride their ponies down into Hollywood. So I thought, how fun is this? This is just a kick. So that became the silent spirit. And, of course, once I found out that there were murders committed and that they are cold cases, then I started putting together a plot that would connect a crime in the past with a crime in the present. And in those situations, Father John and Vicky, they have to solve the crime in the past before they can solve the crime in the present. So those books are challenging to write, and I've had a lot of fun with them. Well, that brings us to The Spider's Web, the latest book. And in this book, it deals with the Sundance, the Arapaho Sundance. The Sundance runs through the book. It's sort of in the background of the book. It's like the I don't know, it's like the main colors in the tapestry of the book. The Sundance is the most ancient and the most sacred of the Arapaho ceremonies. And it's sacred to many other tribes, too. But to the Arapahos, it is most sacred. One of my Arapaho friends said to me, you cannot ever understand us, the Arapaho people, if you don't know about the Sundance. So I have attended the Sundance several times, and this summer I had the chance to be there again while the Sundance was going on. What happens is the elders meet in January, and they decide when the Sundance is going to be held. It is held every year in July, but different dates in July. It takes up a whole week. The first 4 days are all preparatory days, where there's all this ritual that takes place, and there are songs and there are prayers and all of this getting ready. It reminds me, in a way, of of the Christian Holy Week. There's a lot of preparation getting ready for the main event that's going to happen, which is Good Friday and then Easter Sunday. So there are all these things are going on. Now, who dances? I had a friend. I said to a friend this summer, I'm going to the Sundance. She said, oh, are you going to dance? I said, no, I'm not going to dance. Let me tell you why I'm not going to dance. The dancers pledge the dance. That is, they make a commitment to participate in this ceremony. And it's a huge commitment. And the dancers are men. That's another reason I'm not going to dance. But so they make this commitment. They spent a year preparing. They have to learn all these rituals, all these prayers, all these old stories. They learn things that nobody else knows. They're only passed down to people who are preparing themselves for it and who are worthy to learn these things. And so they spend a year doing that. And during the 3 days where the dance actually goes on, they take no food and no liquids for 3 days. I said this to a physician friend of mine. I was telling him about it, and he said, that's impossible. I said, no, it's not. And they've been doing it for, I don't know, thousands of years, eons. Nobody knows how long. Always. They have always, always done it. So what is it? It's a sacrifice. It's something, it's a prayer. I think of it as like an active prayer. It's a prayer that these people choose to participate in, choose to do on behalf of the whole tribe. So it's a prayer, first of all, of thanksgiving for that all that has passed, for all that the tribe has, for the land, for the food, for their lives. And it's a prayer of petition. Asking the Creator's blessings upon the people in the future. It's also a time of reconciliation. It's a time when people who pledge the dance, they usually do it. They often will do it for family members, maybe somebody who is sick, or if there's trouble within a family or somebody's having difficulties, they'll offer this. They'll offer this prayer, this sacrificial prayer, it really is, on behalf of these people. They pray to the Creator. They only believe in one God, and that's the Creator. And so even though the sun, and they dance to the sun, to the rising sun and the setting sun, but the sun is a manifestation of the Creator, a symbol of the Creator. They don't believe the sun is the Creator. So that's what the sun dance is. Now, during the 3 days that they dance, and they dance inside a lodge, and part of the 4 days of preparation are setting up this lodge. And this summer, we got to see some of that. It's very moving. And they bring in a center pole, which they cut down in the mountains, and they bring that onto the reservation. And when that comes onto the reservation, when they're bringing it down, everything stops. They stop all the traffic. Everything stops. It's very quiet, and they bring the pole in. And they set it up. It's the center pole, and that's where the dancers dance around this pole. And then they build what they call a lodge. They put up these other poles around it in a big circle, and then they fill in the sides, the walls, with branches, willow branches and cottonwood branches. And they also make a roof. They put up poles that create the roof structure, and then they cover that with brush so that the dancers have some shade. Before they put up the roof, however, before they put up those poles, they have a ceremony where people can, they file by the poles. The poles are on the ground, and they file by them, and they tie these beautiful pieces of fabric around the poles, and are all very colorful. And each piece of fabric is what they call a prayer flag. It represents a prayer that somebody wants to make along with the dancers. They want to join with the dancers in offering up their prayers. So they tie these flags around the poles. And then when they put the poles up, all these beautiful colored flags are hanging down. Last year I was supposed to go to the Sundance, and at the last minute I wasn't able to go because I got sick. Nothing serious, but I got sick and I couldn't go. So they were very worried about me. And they called me after the Sundance, and one of my friends, and she said, you will never know how many prayer flags were put up for you. So that was really, really touching, since I wasn't all that sick. But, you know, that was nice. I said, I'll take whatever prayers I can get at any time. So that's the Sundance. And I wanted it to be in the background of this story with Ned Winsong is the character who comes back to the reservation, and he comes to participate in the Sundance. He's taken some wrong turns, and he wants to bring himself back in communion with the people, with the Creator. He wants to come back to himself and to his roots as an Arapaho. He wants to change his life. He wants to lead a better life. So he comes back with that intention. And he's preparing for the Sundance. And then this beautiful blonde outsider, this girl, arrives on the reservation and announces that she is Ned Winsong's fiance, which is great, except Ned Winsong has never mentioned having a fiance. And then Ned Winsong ends up, he ends up dead. I'm not telling you anything you're not going to read in the first page or two. He ends up shot to death. And during the attack, the girl, this blonde girl, Marcy, witnesses it. And she's actually attacked herself, not seriously, but she is. And she says, I saw the guys that did it. And she names these two Arapaho men, and she says, they killed him. They did it. However, the people on the reservation, they're looking at her, the outsider, and they're saying, okay, how responsible were you? What did you have to do with this? Because she's an outsider. And then her father comes and hires Vicky to look out for his daughter's interests. So Vicky now is in this very ironic position. This woman who has gone off to become a lawyer so she can protect the rights of her people, she is now protecting the rights of this outsider that everybody on the reservation, her own people, thinks is probably has something to do with the murder of this Arapaho. And Father John also gets to know Marcy. Father John's a counselor. He has heard countless confessions. He is seen into the dark recesses of the human heart. And he spends some time talking to this girl, and he begins to think maybe the Arapaho people have something here. Maybe there is some reason to distrust her. But he also starts to think, and of course, there are more murders that occur in the book. You can never have one murder in a mystery. It's like having one lie. You can't tell one lie because you have to tell other lies to back up that first lie. Well, that's sort of like murder. You know, you can't have just one. You have to have others to, you know, cover up the first one. So as these things begin to happen, Father John begins to think, there's somebody else. There's somebody up the line here who's weaving the web and really behind everything that's going on. And that's why it's called the spider's web. So that gives you an idea of the spider's web. As I say, the Sundance and all of that is kind of in the background. And at the end, the Sundance celebration is finally being held. Well, thank you all so very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.